comes from the American Friends Service Committee, speaking truth to power through peace advocacy, alternatives to military, and its eyes wide open Illinois Memorial. The American Friends Service Committee is a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donation at work, on the web at cs-il.org.
It's 2:40. In sports news, Duke football coach David Cutcliffe quashed any speculation about him returning to Tennessee to succeed his good friend and former boss, Philip Fulmer. "I'm at Duke, staying at Duke," Cutcliffe said today. He twice served on Tennessee's staff and spent 8 years as the Volunteers' offensive coordinator. He came to Duke last December after a 2-year stint in Knoxville and has called Fulmer the best football coach I have ever been associated with. Cutcliffe said he was being proactive because he spoke to recruits who said other coaches had told them that he was headed to the Volunteers. Browns coach Romeo Crennel says it wasn't the fan chants of Brady during Sunday's disappointing loss to Baltimore that prompted him to change quarterbacks for Thursday's game against Denver. Crennel says the decision to go with fan favorite Brady Quinn over an inconsistent Derek Anderson was his and his alone. The Browns are 3-5. It's still unclear just how long Chicago Bears quarterback Kyle Orton will be out with an injured right ankle. There are conflicting reports in the media, and the Bears aren't talking. If Orton can't play, former starter Rex Grossman will start beginning Sunday against the undefeated Tennessee Titans. The Chicago Bulls will try to get a win on the road tomorrow night in Cleveland against the Cavaliers. The Bulls haven't won on the road yet, dropping games to the Boston Celtics last night and to the Orlando Magic. And the Blackhawks would probably like to get back on the ice as quickly as possible after a 6-2 win over the Colorado Avalanche last night, but they'll have to wait until Sunday to play again. They'll host Calgary there in Chicago. That's a look at sports.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Truppen, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services. More information is available at 356-3736. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan for State of Illinois employees and is accepting new patients.
Vintage baseball teams are popping up as a tribute to the sport's tradition-rich 19th-century roots. Two vintage teams based in Illinois, one in Danville and the other in Decatur, recently faced off in a Bloomington exhibition game in an effort to spark interest in a team there. Illinois Public Radio's Laura Kennedy reports.
In 1857, baseball was a gentleman's game, where winning wasn't the point, just a healthy sense of competition and good sportsmanship. This approach hasn't been lost to history. Vintage baseball is a fast-growing sport with 225 clubs from 32 states, combining sport and history. And players are eager to add more teams to the national roster. Bob Droopy Drawer Sampson, captain of the Rock Springs Ground Squirrels from Decatur, says you have to be a special type of person to play vintage baseball.
You have to have a little bit of the competitiveness out of you because the game is really about education, sportsmanship, and friendship.
If Bloomington does form a vintage team, they'll have to learn new rules. Actually, the old rules from 1858. First of all, fielders don't wear gloves. In fact, a player would be considered unmanly to use one. The batter is known as the striker and is only out after swinging and missing 3 times. There are no walks, no balls, and no called strikes. And all pitches are underhanded, says Tim Wiles, director of research at the Baseball Hall of Fame Library in Cooperstown, New York.
So the pitcher's job was basically like a waiter's job, bring me my food. To be an effective pitcher, you had to put the ball just where the hitter wanted it, which, of course, is the exact opposite of today.
The shortstop was called the roamer in 1857, says Marty Tumbleweed Reif of Danville's Vermilion Vols. And the roamer, well, roamed.
He could play wherever he wanted. If I wanted to go out in the outfield and be 4 outfielders, I could play there. I play the infield. I can come up and play in front of the pitcher even.
Although it's not officially in the rules, vintage baseball does have a unique tradition of bestowing nicknames on its players, says Bob Sampson, the man they call Droopy Drawers.
The unofficial rule is you can't give yourself a nickname, and it's usually based on something that, you know, some mistake you've made in the field, or in my case, an unfortunate accident of anatomy, which makes my drawers droop. That's, you know, that part of the fun for a new player is we have to figure out, well, what label can we stick on this poor person that they have to live with the rest of their career?
The most important thing for players to remember, says Marty Reif, is that this is a gentleman's game.
It was not designed for all the enthusiasm, and there was no cussing, there's no sliding, there's no stealing of bases.
The origins of organized baseball came from the gentlemen's clubs of the East Coast. To stay true to the genteel roots of the game, a Bloomington team would be expected to keep their uniforms spotless during games, at least as much as possible. Players and fans, or cranks as they're known, should greet good plays by either side with a rousing cheer of huzzah. Any player who scores must ring a bell by home plate and ask permission of the scorekeeper to tally the run. And instead of the seventh inning stretch, there could be a third inning protest by the local temperance society. Conducted in a very gentle lady sort of way, of course. It can be tough to remain a gentleman, though, when you catch a line drive with your bare hands, says Bob Sampson. The chance of injury is as present as the good manners.
Orthopedic surgeons love vintage baseball because there's occasionally you get a finger shattered and stuff. Usually if you get a broken finger or a hurt finger, it's on some silly infield pop-up that's spinning. And, you know, it hits your finger wrong and hits it. So the injury rate is much lower than one would expect for a bunch of old men playing without gloves.
As for the oldest woman on the Vols squad, 60-something Rita Hustle-Hostetler says nothing hurts her.
The men pull their hamstrings, throw their shoulders out, break their fingers. I'm just loose as a goose because I'm having fun.
The game quickly evolved in the 19th century. And so did the equipment. By the 1880s, all the players were wearing gloves, which allowed the ball to be thrown harder and faster. Tim Wiles of the Baseball Hall of Fame says that as the level of play continued to rise, teams became more focused on winning. The idea was maybe they didn't all have to be gentlemen.
They said, maybe we should let some of these rough-and-tumble Irish guys come into the game and see what they could do. And so they became the first wave of immigrants into the game that sort of de-anglicized it. That entire process was set in motion when the gentlemen decided that winning was more important than being a gentleman of a certain ethnic group.
As the gentlemen and women of the game play their original version of baseball on a field at Miller Park, J.D. Scott of Bloomington watches the Vols and the ground squirrels with keen interest. He says he's excited by the possibility of a local vintage team and even speculates on possible team names.
It seems like everybody's named after a rodent of some sort. So we've got to find something that is very conducive to Bloomington Normal, you know, some rodent.
Name choosing turned out to be premature, as the Bloomington team has yet to materialize. Bob Droopy Drawers Sampson says the Ground Squirrels and the Vols will be back again next season for another exhibition game and another attempt to revive the gentleman's game. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about where their food was grown. Even fewer actually go out and forage in the woods for it. But that's what one chef is trying to get people to do. Julie Grant reports this chef wants people to connect the dots between the environment and their food.
The threat of rain has passed. Cars are pulling in the grassy drive at Kilbuck Valley Mushroom Farm. Chef Ben Bebenroth cuts big leafy greens from the garden as a visiting dog chases a chicken through the yard. Bebenroth is starting preparations for a 6-course meal.
The menu will definitely be a very loose guideline tonight, at best.
Most of the guests have driven an hour from the city in the suburbs of Cleveland. They're dressed for a dinner party, not for hiking. But a hike in the woods is exactly where some of them are going.
Anybody who wants to see wild mushrooms, come hither.
How far and how rough?
Not too rough. We're just going along the bottom of the hollow here.
Farm owners Tom and Wendy Wyant showed their 20 guests honey mushrooms growing on a log. They stopped to explain the difference between puffballs. Some are poisonous, others are delicious. Each person carries a paper lunch bag to fill with fungus.
It's a gold mine up there.
Oh, did this big stump produce this year?
Yeah.
Holy moly, did it ever.
Oh,
see, that's the great thing about dead trees.
Look at that.
You just got to wait till
wow.
That's dinner tonight.
The guests carry their bounty back to the chef, and they're rewarded with a glass of wine. They learn a little more about the Wyans farm, how they cultivate bright yellow oyster mushrooms, fuzzy lion's manes, shiitakes, and more. Chef Ben Bebenroth and his crew are at work in his outdoor makeshift kitchen. He's deciding how to use the mushrooms in various dishes. Some of the guests are excited about getting involved in finding food for the meal. Others are a little skeptical.
This is really farm to table, literally.
It must be for something.
We're a part of that movement, right, Tony?
I'm a Wendy's kind of guy. But
that Wendy's guy was impressed once dinner was being served.
Your first course is going to be a shiitake and truffle tea with the antelope tartare. We put a little bit of the fresh.
After courses of cooked greens and mushrooms, squash with local goat cheese, steaks, desserts, and lots of wine, the party was downright festive.
It is surreal to be here under the stars. You know, the dog on stage, the exquisite cuisine.
Chef Bebenroth creates these dinners at farms around the region through the summer and fall. And despite what seems like a high price, this event was $150 a plate. It's still tough for him to break even on them. But it's important to him. He's taking that idea of farm to table that guests say they want to be involved in and showing them what it really means.
We're so divorced from how our food becomes our food anymore. Now you're empowering people to say, pick this, you know, or they're watching me pick it. That is, to me, that's really completing that circle. And they're starting to understand, okay, it does matter what I put in the air. It does matter what I put in the ground, in the water, you know. This is going into my body. It's going into my kids.
Bebenroth hatched this whole plated landscape idea because he wanted to be outdoors. Now, as his guests drive back to the city and the suburbs, he hopes he's made a few converts, made people see small local farms and the woods as essential to their dinner. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
It's 2:52. You may have wondered why political signs cluster in particular spots outside polling places on Election Day. It's because the Constitution allows a restriction on free speech in key locations. Here's commentator Amy Guida with this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
Depending upon where you vote, you've probably noticed little American flags or perhaps even orange cones set up someplace near the entrance to the polling place. Those markers are there by law to keep the politicians away. Okay, maybe not the politicians so much as their last-minute attempts to woo voters through handshakes, signs, and literature. Here's the language from the Illinois statute. No person shall, at any primary or election, do any electioneering or soliciting of votes or engage in any political discussion within any polling place or within 100 feet of any polling place. If you recall the Constitution's promise of free speech, you might wonder about that prohibition. The law keeps only certain speech, political speech, out of the zone within 100 feet of a polling place. You want to talk about sports? That's okay. And that makes the statute not content neutral. The First Amendment is usually hostile to any sort of prohibition that targets one type of speech alone. But polling places, they're different. The Supreme Court decided as much a few years ago in a case from Tennessee. There, a city council candidate apparently wanted to politic in some way within the 100-foot no zone, and so the campaign argued that a prohibition against such politicking was unconstitutional. But the Supreme Court disagreed. A prohibition on political speech on Election Day at key locations was constitutional, a majority of the justices decided, because the government has a compelling interest in securing the right to vote freely and effectively. Keep politicians, their ilk, and their ink away, and you help prevent voter intimidation and voter fraud. This wasn't pulled out of thin air by the justices. It used to be, they explained, that voters made their own ballots, marked them at home, and carted them to the polls for counting. But political parties soon recognized an opportunity and printed their own ballots, wooing or bribing or intimidating voters into voting the party's way, and often competing heatedly with others for a wavering voter right there at the voting place. But it wasn't just political parties behind the intimidation. Perhaps you've heard about a recent public education campaign by corporate CEOs to encourage employees to take an hour off work to vote. Well, apparently their predecessors once embraced this cause too zealously. The 46th Congress, the justices wrote, reported that men were frequently marched or carried to the polls in their employers' carriages, furnished with ballots, and compelled to hold their hands up with their ballots in them so they could easily be watched until the ballots were dropped into the box. Some workers simply stayed away from the polls. Others who voted the wrong way lost their jobs. So that's why we have such secrecy in voting today, the majority explained, and why we have a prohibition on those who would politic close to the polls. The change in voting law toward voter protection and voting secrecy kept employers, party bosses, police officers, and saloon keepers away from polling places and made election days, a commentator wrote in 1888, as peaceful as our Sabbaths. So today there's this in the same Illinois voting statute. No person shall interrupt, hinder, or oppose any voter while approaching within those areas for the purpose of voting. And there's no electioneering within 100 feet of a polling place. Here, concerns about a fair election trump free speech concerns. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. And we hope you'll spend election night with WILL. NPR and Illinois Public Radio coverage begins at 6 p.m. on AM 580 and FM 90.9 with local results from WILL AM reporters. PBS coverage on WILL-TV begins at 8 p.m. And, of course, you can visit our election website for updates and running vote totals in key races. That's WILL.illinois.edu, will.illinois.edu.
Earth and sky.
On the long term, oil is a finite resource. Finding new oil, that is not that easy anymore.
You are listening to Willem Schulte, Shell's chief scientist for reservoir engineering. Earth Sky asks Schulte if the world is running out of oil.
Well, the short answer is no, not at the moment. What they call easy oil from the fields we are producing at the moment are leveling off. And to be able to boost our production levels, we need techniques like enhanced oil recovery.
He spoke of several ways to squeeze more oil out of existing reservoirs. This is oil that is locked up between grains of sand and rocks and can't be easily pumped. He said about two-thirds of the world's oil remains trapped underground, and that there are about three main ways to use today to push that locked-up oil to the surface.
Those techniques are chemical injection, that is like soap, thermal methods like heating up the oil so that it flows easier, or gas injection.
Schulte said enhanced oil recovery only accounts for about 5% of current world production, about